Let's just start by, you know, maybe you guys introducing yourselves. And, you know, I would love to know kind of where you're from and how you met.
Robert Diemer, from Massachusetts, Worcester, Massachusetts. I joined the Marine Corps in 85. And when I got out in 89, 90, joined the Los Angeles Police Department, and I was in class 590, May 90. And then
that was 690.
Okay.
690. And
How long have you guys known each other then? What is that?
87.
How did we meet? We were talking about it earlier.
And when you're in the Marine Corps and you're in Okinawa, you do one of two
things. We were stationed in Okinawa. I was in 3rd Recon, getting in dock.
I was with the 12th Marines.
Okay.
And so you either do one of two things. You either are a workout fanatic or you're a drinker. Mm-hmm. When I went, our facilities were so lacking.
Yeah.
You're online for 10 minutes just to do some curls. And I was like, oh, I guess I'm drinking. So one of those days, I just didn't care. I walked down to a town in Okinawa, and I was ready to just get on the bus and go get lost in town. And I had a splitting headache. I was getting over a hangover. And next you know, I hear, hey! And it pierced my skull. I looked over, and it was Bob. And I looked at him, and I guess the way I looked at him, I thought he was gun under my shoe. And so he looked at me and goes, fuck you. And I looked at him, and I'm like, what? He goes, fuck you. I'm like, where you even come from? So he steps out into the traffic, but he looks the wrong way. Japanese traffic is the opposite way. So he looks the wrong way and almost gets hit by a cab. And I'm like, well, I'll give him the first hit. After that, I'm going to destroy him.
Yeah.
So he's there. He's, you know, waiting for me in the street. Like, dude, we're in Japan. And next, you know, the weird thing about it, he flips like this. Once he saw I wasn't going to fight him, he comes over and he sits right next to me. What the hell? And
I took that as
the
a
way
victory.
He wasn't skinny.
I ran with that.
He wasn't skinny. He was extremely lean.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is one of those recon guys. God damn it. Those guys are hard to deal with, the recon guys. So I'm like, fuck. Yeah. She goes, so where you from? I go, what? He goes, where you from? I go, the Bronx. He goes, the Bronx, Boogie Down Bronx. Yeah, I was and when he started the conversation, I'm like, who is this guy? No, ever since then, we were the best of friends.
There you go. Best of friends.
Why'd you say fuck you to him in the first place?
I don't know. I had a lot. It's same thing. You know, either you work out or you drink. I had a long evening. And I had the, the soju muscles going.
Oh, soju.
And I called him out, and he cowered it out. You know, he has his version. I have mine. He said, he goes, I don't want any trouble from you. And I said, okay. You know, move over, let me have your spot. He gave up his spot and I sat there.
Yeah.
So, and you know, and I took it as a victory.
I wasn't that drunk.
he told the truth, you know, but from that time on, we've been really good friends.
And tell me just about the Marines. Like, what specifically about recon for you?
I didn't know what recon was in the first place. I joined, I was going to college in Worcester, Mass, and it wasn't working out. I just looked up to the Marine Corps. I never forget when Beirut got a hotel that the Marines passed. Some of them died there. And I never forget that one Marine going, oh, we're not leaving. We're going to stay here. And I remember black and white TV just fixated on that Marine, intensely saying, no, we're not leaving. We got our brothers in there. We're going to stay as long as we have to get them out. And I went, oh, my God. And that's where it started. And so I ended up finally getting into the Marine Corps and then went to Paris Island.
Were you in Paris Island as well?
I was in Paris Island also.
Yeah, all the East Coast, anything west of the Mississippi, east of the Mississippi, Paris Island. And so I went there and I graduated, and then I went to infantry training school, and they had this dog and pony show with recon. They repelled in and they spy rigged out. And I'm like, holy cow, this is insane.
Superheroes.
I'm like, insane. So they go, well, I'm standing there, this big guy like Jeff, real taller, a little bit taller, big dude. And they go, who wants to try out, show of hands, and then come over here? So I raised my hand, and I went, what, am I crazy? I'm not going to do this. So I put my hand down. And the big guy next to me had his hands up, and he goes, well, at least you had the guts for raising your hand. And I'm like, here we go again. So I raise my hand, and we go out. And so anyhow, that weekend, it was an all-day in dock.
It was what?
All day in dock, in okay. Docker Nation.
Gotcha.
And once you got off that cattle car, which is like
our version of public transportation, yeah. Which is literally a cattle car.
Yeah, right. We unload, and it was on like boot camp, but more intense because you're at a different level. And, you know, you had to do the obstacle course twice. Then you had a 3-mile run with your boots on. And then your 2.5-hour swim test where they tie your hands and legs together. You had to float. You had to go off a diving board and then in. And it was rough. And then you had about a 10-mile force march, pack march, which is like a run. They called it a running to extract sort of thing. You know, meaning you're trying to get to a point.
Yeah.
So, you know, to get extracted. And, man, I think we started out with, like, over 40, and we finished with 13.
Is that right?
I was 13.
Wow.
But I was 45 minutes. the back strap of my, you know, you fill, before you start, you fill up your backpack with sand, 50 pounds of sand. And they don't know. They're like, oh, I'll put a little more in there. You're like, oh, my God. So so you're off and you're running. And I barely made it. I was just so happy when I finished everything. But that pack run, I was done, man. Mm. And I never forgot one guy goes, you're late. You didn't make it. And I said, at least I finished. And they go, where's the gunny? Gunnery sergeant's a high-ranking guy, and he was in charge. And they go, oh, he's back in the rear right now. And they go, good. Guy just nails me. I go into the sand, and they're watering me off. But I never forget when they were pouring water on me, I got that half mouth in water, one out, and I'm just like, yeah, I didn't even care. Hit me all you want. I'm done, you know? So after it was over, I'm like, you know, you have the big guy that said,
yeah, the said at least you,
he was on the first 3-mile run. He's on a Jeep doing this.
Gone.
And I'm looking at him like it gave you that sense. You yeah. know how it is. You know, you're tired, but you see something that pulls you through. And I looked at him and he looked at me and looked down, you know. So that was at the beginning.
Mm.
So I finished at the end. So I'm like, I get in the cattle car and we're talking. The guys left there. The rest are gone. And there's about 13 of us, and they go, what do you think? And I go, I'm just glad I'm done, man. I'm just done. I'm done. And we're just talking. And all of a sudden, the cattle car speeds up, and they're going to take us back. And then about a minute into it, it pulls over. And they go, get off. We're running back to base. And I'm like, I'm gone. I'm done, man. And my buddy Smitty, he's from Jersey.
Yeah.
I go, dude, I'm going to run 50 yards, and I'm gonna crap myself. Yeah. And throw up. I'm going to make myself throw up. Yeah. I'm done. And he goes, I don't think I can do it either. And so we get up, and I'm like, oh, this is ridiculous, man. And they said, ready? Let's go. 20 feet in. They go, okay, stop. Get back in. And three guys quit right at the beginning.
Wow.
And we got in, and that's the rest is history. That last, how bad you want it. You know what I mean? So I made it in. And I didn't.
You would have run back. You would have run the whole way back if you had to.
Man, I still remember that day. I was like, I wouldn't have made myself throw up. I would have ran until I, you know,
because
it's that always trying to prove something. Yep. That's what.
And who is that, to yourself or to the other guys?
Probably both. Mm-hmm. Even when I was in high school, it was like I was always undersized. My dad took off when I was very young. So there was, you know, that was a huge, you know, you don't have that major influence, which kind of relates to our job later and what we do now, Jeff, you know, with these kids on the street. That's how I have that, not being that great in school. You know, not having that parental, you know, father, that male figure. And that's what I can kind of latch in and pull off and say, I've been there, and look them in the eye. And they can't deny it because I'm bringing stuff up that they feel, you know, I've been there. You know what I mean? You get emotional.
No way you're connecting unless you've been there, right?
You gotta feel it. Yeah. Like, I'm getting emotional now. Yeah. You feel that struggle, man. And so with that, you know, you get older and you get sick of the fight. And but when you're young, you need that. You know that in acting, you need that edge. You need something to get you through. And I know Jeff's gone through that. We're blood in, blood out, me and him. This guy's my relative. He's my brother. We are not friends. We are brothers.
What would you say your biggest takeaway from the Marines are? And I'm also interested in what you think, what makes a good Marine?
I mean, being there, you just don't give up. Two, you're loyal. That's why when instead of, you know, patrol's good, I went into the crash unit because it was that kind of camaraderie where, you know, you can work together. You know who you're working with. You've had the same amount of training. They're just as fervent with you about the knowledge you have about the gangsters in the area. And being in the Marines for me was like that, where, you know, it's a total professional organization where once you go in the field, you know, you may not bathe as often. You may motherfuck each other, excuse my language. But when it comes to being ready for combat, you're not going to leave each other.
And then if you want to tell this story, we lost touch with each other.
Oh, yeah. We lost. Well, after Okinawa, we lost touch. And he told me, you know, fuck that. I ain't going to California. It's not my place. And I said, okay. You know, because I got married before I went to Okinawa. And he goes, I'm going back to Boston. I go, well, maybe I'll visit him. So here it is. A couple of years later, I'm in the academy. They hired me out of General Dynamics. I was building airplanes. Mm. I dropped out of high school. And then I'm in General Dynamics building airplanes. And so now I'm in the academy and I'm the class leader. You got to be there first. You got to make sure everything's done. And I'm going through my locker and I hear, hey, I'm like, no fucking way. I turn around and there he was.
Those voices, yeah.
I go, Bob. We hugged each other and the whole locker room went silent.
Yeah.
And he looked down and we realized we were in our underwear hugging in the locker room. And he shoved me away, said goodbye, and then took off. And everybody looked at me like, what the hell?
Dude? What were
like,
you doing then?
And there's a rivalry between classes. They were a rivalry.
And, I was 690.
Yeah, and I was 590. And so there was a rivalry. We would compete together, right?
Yeah.
In all this stuff. So, and that's when the classes, when we, you know, were over 100 with LAPD. Now they're small. I think they can't be over 40 or 50 or something like that.
Yeah, and we would do things to kind of screw each other over, but we can get over that because we're such good friends. He would walk up and say, hey, Jeff, how do you like my shirt? Because we compete in running. He goes, oh, never mind. How about this? You recognize the back? You know?
Yeah.
So it's stuff like that.
I was a runner. Yeah, I was a runner back then.
No, we were all runners.
But historically, there's been this connection, right, between the Marine Corps and LAPD for a long time, right?
Yes.
I mean, like Chief Parker was it. I mean,
It
was before Chief Parker, yeah.
It was one of the most corrupt in the nation. It was the most corrupt department. And finally, it had to be revamped. They got taken over, I think, federally. And they brought in a Marine Corps general to redesign LAPD.
Right.
They redesigned the badge. And if you look at the uniform of Los Angeles police officers, it's the same cut as the Marine Corps uniform. Same thing. It's almost all the same thing. And also the simplicity of the Marine Corps uniform. You don't have patches unless you're in SWAT or traffic. You don't have patches on our actual wool uniforms. So it was designed by a Marine, and then he handed it to Chief Parker. And Chief, if you can believe it, Chief Parker was used as a model for a TV show. And guess who it was?
Who's that?
It was Spock.
Wow.
Yeah, Gene Roddenberry was a Marine, was a sergeant in Southwest. And then he wrote Star Trek, and he couldn't have Spock lead the ship, so he had to pick another character, which was with William Shatner.
Wow.
So it was just useless
trivia. He's a Trekkie.
Oh, are you?
Yeah,
Is there...
You wouldn't think so, but he's a nerd.
Do you still have a lot of officers coming on the job, coming out of the Marine Corps?
There was a couple of years where...
Before, when we came on, it was a lot of
Marines. It was a lot.
And after Vietnam, right? I mean, there was an influx.
Yes. Yeah, so you still have a lot of, if you look at these guys, they still have the Marine Corps pins,
yeah,
naval pins. So you have a lot of...
Pretty much, Jeff, we're pretty much the only one under the badge on the lapel. The Marines wear their, on LAPD, wear a little EGA, Eagle Globe and Anchor.
Some Army do too. My
Some
son wears his.
But the Marines are definitely, you see all the Marines wearing the EGA.
And would you say that in the criteria for being a good Marine and also for being a good cop, it lives primarily in loyalty?
Dedication to duty.
Dedication.
Dedication to duty. One of the things you don't want to do.
Semper Fidelis, always faithful.
Even in this atmosphere where my wife, she's had enough, you know, the stress that was on her. And she goes, if you get killed, I don't even think anybody will appreciate it. But that was her opinion, and I don't blame her. And I hope a lot of the citizens who are the silent majority that back us stop being silent. Because if not, we're going to lose all these good young officers that are just going to take off some, like those 15 officers in South Central. You know, we can't afford to lose good cops here. We can't.
Well, and I think, look, I mean, this is definitely the direction that I want to get into.
But just to piggyback, please. It's just when you come on, am I right? Mm-hmm. The academy is one thing. But to feel like you know what you're sort of doing takes at least 5 years. So you have 6 months in the academy, a year on probation, rookie status, and then you're off. But after that, it takes... What would you say? Will you feel
No, it's proven it takes 5 years for an officer to become cost effective.
I mean, if you're ever going to have a relationship to the community, you have to spend time in the community. And then if you spend
But the thing is, that's why in LAPD, when you do your probation in one area, they put you in a whole other area because you don't want someone that's just in one community. You want them to be used to several communities.
I think the best division to work pretty much here is Hollywood because everything's there. And everybody lives there. It's very diverse. Plus, the tourist is from everywhere in the world. And so you get everything in Hollywood. And you become, I think, a really well-rounded officer to handle the basics and as well as everything else. But that's, well, Jeff and I ended up in Hollywood together.
Was that where you first, where was the first place you started in LA?
77th.
77th?
77th.
And so 77th, then we're talking what year? 80?
No. No, 1990.
Just explain to me what 1990 LA is like. Like that those next.
The 90s?
Yeah, just explain really to me what that was like. And then take me through sort of your time on the gang unit.
Well, when I first, after the academy and I was in 77th, you're not used to dealing with actual civilians in that capacity where they can actually, a lot of the criminals can take advantage of you. Sometimes you don't recognize the signs of something's about to go upside down. That's why these more experienced officers, what we call the P3s, the two-stripe, mm-hmm. will at least recognize, okay, he's not seeing this, so he'll take over from there. New Year's Eve, before we hit 1991, the training officer goes, God damn it. And he starts speeding up. And I don't know what this guy is up to. So as he's turning the corners, okay, we're about to get into a gunfight. He goes under a bridge. He gets out of the car and leans up against the wall and waits. So he goes, you might want to get out of the car. So I get out of the car and I lean up against the wall and we're like between pillars. And next thing you know, he goes, no. Nah. And it scared the shit out of me when all you hear is
gunfire
everywhere. I mean, you just hear it all go off for like a full minute and a half. And then people are reloading and still firing up in the air. And then next thing you know, you hear it. The rounds coming back down, hitting the cars, breaking windshields. Like, what the heck? I've never even heard of this. I mean, I've never even heard of this in the news. And that sort of thing was my introduction to Los Angeles.
But that went all the way through the 90s because we had a gun suppression, which we did training for gun suppression detail for New Year's. And so we would sit on some of the hot zones and we would hear the fire and then move in.
That was like 96, 97. It's very rare someone will come out and shoot in the air. So we were able to, we had like a just contingents of officers everywhere. that as soon as the shooting starts, radio call starts, we're out there and we're going to confront whoever's shooting up in there.
Now, you both were crash in the early 90s.
He worked Hollywood Crash. I was at Hollywood. I was working. We started, me and this other officer started a narcotics car. And it's a dying art right now. It's called, it was called the hype car for a hypodermic needle, which was for heroin. But we called it the hype car. And it was arresting people for 11-550, which is under influence of a stage one narcotic, which is heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, you know, stage one drugs that are illegal. There's no medical use for them whatsoever. So, you know, and now I started one in the valley at Van Nuys, but when we met, I started another one. I got hit up by Captain Dial.
Phenomenal. Best captain ever.
Best captain ever.
What made him? What made her?
Oh,
she was a good leader. She was even keeled.
She was a great street cop.
Was she from the community?
No, she was from back east somewhere, but she came out here, and she was a street cop. Everybody, Connie Dial, everybody that mentioned her name, you were like, ooh. You know, she held her weight back then. You know, she went to the academy where, you know, she told me that they didn't want women on the job. So they really, women that came on back then really went through a lot, and she came on once again with the desire, I'm going to show these guys, and she worked phenomenally. She worked undercover, and she would have a great person to get on to talk to, because I don't want to give her background, because your mouth would drop.
Yeah, that's her background, yeah. Is and interesting. So, when I left, I mean, I retired in October, and it was just in time for the election. And usually you would feel like a whole weight. When you retire, you feel like a weight's lifted off your shoulders. Mm-hmm. You gain years in your life. Mm-hmm. But that's only partly so, because when you have kids on the job that are still in the street, taking those risks, fighting those fights, trying to help citizens, you kind of lose sleep at night.
Of course.
You know, so no matter what, you just pray for them, and you're kind of like, instead of crossing over to retirement, I got mine, you know, moving on with your life, you're still there.
Of course.
And so I remained as a reserve. So I went from full pay cop to working for free. And one of the reasons is the program I work for is a great program called PAL, Police Activities League.
Yep.
And man, we help so many families. You lose a few kids though. And that's a sad story. We have one kid. We kept telling the parents, you need to move out of our case manager. Amy kept telling them, you need to move now.
Why?
Because the kid, unfortunately, these parents let these kids collect. Every time I did search, we did search warrants, and we noted, Bob and I did search warrants. We did probation searches, parole searches. And then we had to do it with the juveniles, because every one of them had all the collection of movies where it's a great recruitment tool.
Blood in, Blood Out, American Me,
Scarface is the number one. You see Scarface poster.
Sorry, so you're saying that it's a recruitment tool.
It's a great recruitment tool.
For who?
For the gangs,
right,
that we're working against, yep, and recruiting these kids.
Yep.
They didn't need much with this kid. This kid's in a poor family. Both parents are immigrants. Mom's trying to do the best she can from home. Dad's working and they're struggling. And our PAL program, we really try and provide things for the family. There's only so much we can do.
You know, all the guys that we've spoken to, you know, we were talking to a bunch of the guys from the Pueblos, and they all had very good things to say about you, and things about the fact, and a lot of it was the fact that you are not only willing, but that you want to communicate, and that you treat people like human beings. And I really want to get into that. I guess what I want to know,
I just want to reiterate, just a quick story.
Yeah.
Well, I arrested, I don't know the number, but a lot, hundreds of people from the influence. It pays off in the end. And I'm at Gold's Gym at Venice, and I see this guy staring at me, tatted up, sleeved up, and he has devil horns tattooed to his head. And he's looking at me. I'm like, man, I better put some weight up today.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
And that ain't happening.
Yeah.
So I go to a chess machine, and he comes walking towards me, and I do the nervous thing. You kind of look down, but you see the 2 feet.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I look up, and I'm like, and he goes, "Hey, are you Deemer?" And I go, "Yes, I'm Deemer." And he goes, "Broke right there." And he goes, "Oh, man. Well, you know what? You arrested me 4 times. And I go, "Whoa, I hope we're cool." Like, you know, and he goes, "No, we're cool, man." And he was telling me, in the underworld, with me and my partner, he goes, "You guys are famous." And he goes, you got me off. You got me off. And he got all emotional. And he's a guy with devil horns, like getting emotional. And I said, you know, I was able to get up, and it was weird from standoffish. I got my arm around this guy. Like, you know, I'm like, "Well, I'm glad you're off. You look good, you know, and you know, you look solid." And
you got him sober.
Yeah. And he attributes that. And yeah, he was so happy to see me, because I guess maybe I was part of this step to recovery.
Sure.
And he goes, "Can I ask you for a favor?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure." And he goes, "Can you come to an AA meeting with me?"
Wow.
I went.
Good for you.
And I spoke, and it was unbelievable.
He showed up in uniform.
But you do that. I mean, you do that, man. And,
yeah.
And I guess
it. But I got something out of it, too.
Of course.
I was like, because we're not going to arrest our way out of this problem. We're not going to, from drugs to gangs. And you're not going to make it easy on yourself if you don't have the ability to communicate and talk to people and find people interesting like we do, Jeff. And, you know.
Isn't it a step further? Because what I see with you, and obviously I see with you and how you talk about your family, and I can just see it on you. And you know, we've been friends for years, but you have this huge heart, and you have empathy. And when we first rode out in Newton together, you and me are out there, we're talking to everybody. You know, and you were like, "Why are you giving everybody your numbers?"
Yeah.
Like, the guys who I was speaking with the other day, you know, and even I was talking to some guys who are active gang members too, and they all were, you know, when you were brought up, they talked about how you went to the hospital, there was a young kid from cancer there, and how you went and you stayed with them, and you visited, and you were in there day after day after day, and
Semi.
How much that means. And
there's a story with that. His name was Semi, and I'll try to pull up a photo, and we made him a woman, her name is Jackie Franklin. She works with Newton. She's works the admin section. Her family are seamstress, and they made the little boy a cop uniform using Newton Division old cops uniforms.
You know about the boy, yeah, the child he's talking about?
I don't know. Well, I just know what they told
me. The story is my partner and I, we went and talked to this gang member. The whole family emptied out of the living area, the apartment area, and they were
this
like
down the Pueblos.
Yeah, and you know me, John, I love a challenge.
Yeah.
And they're yelling at me like, "Why are you stopping him?" Even the guy was like, "Hey, he just wants, he's cool, man. He's just asking where I live, everything." And they're yelling at me, so I turn over to him. I go, what's going on?" And they're like, "You're harassing and all this stuff." And I'm like, "What's harassing? I'm talking to the guy." And I love that. I love mixing it up.
Sure.
And I don't mind being called names.
Yeah.
I don't mind, because, come on, the way we were all raised, if you know, playing football and just growing in high school, you know, names hurt, but, you know, when you're hard and you get up, it isn't about falling down, it's getting up. And if you're one of those guys that keeps getting up, names don't mean anything.
Yep.
Because I'm going to show you.
Yeah.
And so I'm talking to him, and here's little Semi. And he's looking at me, in a way, looking up to me like, wow. You know, it's like, this kid is, you know, I go, "What's your name?" And I'm like, looking at him, "You don't need to talk to him." I go, "What's your name?" He goes, "Semi." I go, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And he goes, "I want to be a cop." And that's where it all started. But yeah, I didn't know he had cancer then. So I had a hookup with the Hip Hop Square show.
Uh-huh.
And I had about 2 seats left in the van and I offered it to this family. So everything calmed down when he said he wanted to be a cop, because I'm living large now. I got you.
Yeah,
I got you. And two of them came to the station, which was huge, from anti-cop. I'm taking them to Hip Hop Squares in a van.
Right.
So we're there. Cedric the Entertainer's there. T.I. Everybody was there. Michael Easley.
Yeah.
You know, all these great stars. And it was a great day. The stars came back and talked to him. But these three of them actually came, and they came up to me and they go, "Hey, Deemer, you're legit." that little boy you were talking to has brain cancer. And I just, I just, my heart sank. It just totally, and that's where it started. And we started getting it going. But that kid was like a guiding light that we were in that unit that we do outreach, and it cemented that unit that we're here not to do only enforcement, but to work with the community as well as some of the gang members and try to find this common balance.
But that common, that thing is kind of exactly what I'm trying to get at and explore. Because I think, you know, I remember the first night we went out, you were talking about some of the guys who don't get out of the car and some of the guys who sort of just stay in the car, and that they, anytime they talk with this, you know, voice that they're the baddest guy, and they're the baddest motherfucker on the street, and that everything is aggression and everything. And there's never going out like this, never going out with outreach, never going out with saying like, hey, I'm a human being, you're a human being. And to me, I think that there's something very real about being a confident man, about being a confident human being, about not being consumed by fear, that only when we can do that can you actually go and connect with people. And I saw it there. And I guess just in terms of policing, it's really something I want to get into with you guys, but what do you think makes a good police officer? Like who is the best cop that you've ever known and why?
From the example you just gave, you... there's some people that need to be approached that way, okay? And I think it, maybe it's lack of life experience, but there's some people that need to be approached that way, but with the others, you need to approach them differently.
Hey, Jeff, tell them about the traffic stop we did.
There was one traffic stop we did where...
we were working together.
The guy was really combative, and he was just calling us names, and he goes, you just stopped me because I'm black. And the whole thing, and Bob saw that the man was seriously stressed. So I was like, okay, let me see. Sometimes I stand by to see what Bob does. Mm-hmm. Not that he's entertainment, but he was entertaining. And he goes, okay, we're going to start again. We're going to rewind. And then he started going, and he started walking backwards towards the car. I'm like, are you serious? Is he actually doing that? And then he opened it up, and then he closed the car door again, and he walked up.
He went reverse.
Yeah, he did it. He did it in reverse. And he walked up. He goes, good afternoon, sir. How can I help you? You know, I just wanted to tell you. And the guy he was an older gentleman, too. He got the hint. He goes, well, sir, you know, I didn't mean to. I couldn't believe he played along. And he goes, yeah, considering you're not denying it, that means I don't have to change your behavior with a ticket. I'm going to let you off with a warning. You have a nice day. And the guy stayed there, and he goes, he's looking around. He looked at me.
Got out of the car.
And he said, that's it? He goes, that's it, sir. You have a great day. As if nothing else has happened. Wow. So then he took off from there.
Guy couldn't
believe it. So he de-escalated the whole thing just doing that.
But that's the working with this guy. We believed in each other. I didn't stop him. You know, I really didn't have to ever. But we knew what we were going to do in any tactical situation, and we knew if it didn't go our way, we could, in a sense, make it right, like the traffic stop. You know, it was humor.
Well, if it goes south, let's say the conversation goes south from there, I know where to take over from him.
Yeah.
It's one of those things you don't let your partner sink in the situation, because sometimes, I mean, we're human beings, and you're going to do what you got to do. There's a time where you're like, okay, partner,
yep.
You know, you grab him by the gun belt. And I got it from here. You handcuff the guy, you put him away for now, and then you talk to your partner.
And this is what I love about, like, you know, like Jeff and other officers that we could work the whole city. We could work the valley, West Valley out there, where we could eat good every night and the public supports it. But we're in the South End. You know why I like being down there? Because it's real. Makes me feel at home. You know, when people are going to tell you what time it is.
Without naming names, what's the worst shit that you've seen cops do? Like, what's the shit that you don't respect at all about police officers that you've seen? Like,
I first came on, I didn't like the way some of them talk to people. And some don't wave to people. I didn't like it when I was in the Bronx. You're there and you wave to the cops and they just look at you and they keep driving. I think one cop waved to me and say, you know, hey, how you doing?
I'm going to really interrupt. That is a big deal. That means a lot to a kid.
Like, do you see guys joining up for the wrong reasons and you see people
talking
the talk?
You see it everywhere. I mean, it's this department's too big not to have something like that. I mean, you have your variety. And like I can tell you truthfully, 99% of officers are the best. Okay. A tiny, tiny percentage of that you may have to straighten out. And then you got those like the Rampart scandal. Those guys you got to flush down the toilet.
Yep.
But there were a few where, I mean, there were a couple that were had the wrong attitude. And but they were good people, but they weren't going in the direction we wanted as a gang unit. So Bob and I had to cut them down.
I think that there is something very dangerous about people who are consumed by fear. And I think that there's something right now in this country where there's this connection between fear and race. And people are going into traffic stops and you got cops who are just afraid. And maybe it's cops who haven't, you know, worked in places like you guys have worked and have been face to face dealing with people every day and can pick up signs and you guys have the experience. So I just want to see what you guys think about.
Well, that's why to me as an officer, I've recommended to my son, listen, you gotta change gears and you gotta work in different areas. Okay. Because working in Armenian neighborhoods is gonna be different from working in East LA or South Central. You have to get used to the people that are there. What some consider bad manners may not be bad manners to other people. You gotta really diversify yourself as a human being.
You know, I grew up in Massachusetts and Worcester, and I really didn't respect the police officers too as a kid.
Sure.
And
were you the same?
I was standoffers with them.
Right. Yeah.
Because like I said, I tried to be a good kid. You wave to them. Nobody waves to you back. And that has a profound effect on you.
And I just want to ask you real quick, because I do want to get into the, like, and tell me if you guys need to take a break, take a piss or whatever, just let me know. But, okay. But like, so right, pretty like right off after you guys started was Rodney King, correct?
Yeah. When I first, well, you were asking about the 90s. When I first came into LAPD in the 1990s, the first thing that I saw that was so prevalent in the street and the violence was because of the Rockwell King. It was still relatively new in 1990. Everyone's still taking over areas because if you take over area, you get all the money that the area makes in selling and all the people. I mean, it's like a giveaway. And so
the violence was just...
The violence is a result of that. I mean, you always have violence. But the amount of violence that amazed me was over the drug trade and them fighting for control over the drug trade. And so the Rocco Kane was still, you know, relatively new, and it was huge business. And it was really hard to deal with because it was prevalent and everybody wanted to be in the business.
And being, you know, for lack of a less cheesy fucking term, you being a soldier in the war of on drugs, like what is your take on that now?
Anybody caught, if it's within the law, you got to put them in jail. But at the same time, you can't arrest your way out of things. They're offering programs. As long as you're not the dealer, they will help you. See what I mean?
But like, if the crack epidemic was right now, how do you think it would be? Would it be handled the same way? Would it be handled different?
It would be handled differently.
100%. And that's a good thing.
It's a very good thing.
Yeah.
Look at the COVID. You remember when it first came out, nobody knew how to handle it?
Sure.
Some say, you know, okay, just let's not make a big deal out sure. of it until we know the ramifications.
Sure. Sure.
Others like, no, you know, you got to wear 10 masks now.
Yeah.
But now we basically have the tests that
some
are accurate.
Yeah.
And so when we got hit with this drug epidemic, which was even worse than before,
yeah.
What can you do? So the only thing you can do is make laws and make it heavy hitting.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of programs out there to get people off drugs. There should be a lot more, you know, because it's very few totally get off drugs. It's just, I couldn't imagine the process and how the addiction, you know, how it just consumes you. You know, I have a cousin that is our drug addict, and it's a constant struggle, and just arresting people over and over for that, for the
narcotics. They can get the stuff in jail too.
Of
course.
Yeah, they
of
can,
course.
Yeah, like Jeff said too, what we both said, you can't arrest yourself out of it. There's got to be a lot more programs than what they have.
The scourge of the crack epidemic, though, I mean, that's, you know, and that obviously it was huge in the areas that you guys patrolled, and that was predominantly.
But there's always another drug to take over, like fentanyl now.
Of course.
And then, but also the old drugs are coming back. Like, I hear PCP's coming
back. PCP came back for a bit, and in Boyle Heights, there's a certain area where they deal in PCP.
Yeah.
So, getting back to the fear thing.
He gets you? Multiple migs here right there.
Yeah, he's on it. He's an on it.
This guy's pure muscle.
I thought that was Jeff, actually.
He's going to start it on me, isn't he?
So, the dirty mustache. His nickname came because we would be working together and he would constantly eat, right? Constantly eat. By the end of watch, he had a donut, a pizza. He could feed a family of five with his mustache. So I go, dirty mustache. And man, it was like, you know, that mustache was filthy at the end of watch.
Do you guys remember sort of where you were when you saw the Rodney King tape?
I was on
what
base.
That meant to you? Okay.
I was on probation in 77th Division. And when the war broke out, I got my orders and they took me out and I wound up in El Toro. We were waiting by the planes to go into the Middle East. And next, you know, the war's over. So I'm sitting on base and this one African-American Marine says, "Hey man, come look at your boys in action." I go, "What?" He goes, "Come look at your boys in action." So I walk over there and they're beating the crap out of this guy on TV. I go, "No, that's not LAPD. They don't do that." He goes, "Mm-hmm." He turned up the volume and sure enough, it was. I'm like, "Holy shit." So what am I going to go back to? Next year I go back and after the war and we're wind up in front of 7919 Southwestern. The reason 7919 sticks out in my mind is because that's where that little black girl got shot by the Korean lady. And so what happens is one of our officers, a good man, you know, he goes in there. He sees the lady, the girl's on the floor. He sees the lady there with the 357. Basically, he took the 357 and they made a crime scene. They're, what the hell's going on? So they looked at the video and they said, okay, this is a straight up homicide. So they took into custody, got the crime scene going. And next, you know, the judge puts the lady on probation. So once she puts her on probation, the lady heads on the plane, goes back to Korea. There's nothing we can do. So what does the community do? They're pissed off. And where's the next place you're going to focus on when you're pissed off? It's us.
That's right.
It's us. So when I come back, we're in front of there and the people are protesting and we just want to make sure that nothing bad was going to happen. And I understood. You know, I'd be pissed off too.
Sure.
Because that was totally disrespectful. But the focus then came on us. That's why now with what's going on, everyone's looking for that boogeyman that we're not. So what happens is some prominent people made them believe that that boogeyman is us. And that is not the case. That is a total lie. And they should be ashamed because now you're going after a bunch of public servants that risk their lives every day. And when you sit in that car, you're going to possibly lose your house, your life, everything you've ever worked for. All you need is one mistake. One mistake. After God knows how many years of serving the community, and you're done. You lose everything. People are going to do what you train them to do. You're going to do what you were trained to do because outside of that is panic. So if you don't have good training, you're going to go to panic right away. You're going to go to fear. But if you're trained, you're going to go straight to your training. Like if you're boxing, you're doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you're caught in a bad situation, you're going to do what you're trained to do.
You go back to the well, D.C., Massachusetts, the Bronx, you know, and you're going to go back to what you know. And, you know, it's like, you know, Jeff's son, Jeff Jr., he's trained martial arts. Jeff's a boxer.
No, it was the first thing he said to me. You know, I asked him, you know, what his training, and you said jiu-jitsu, and he was talking about MMA, and he's like, you know, it's the best stuff to use out on the field. And I think that there's this huge misconception right now in the public that you know, police officers are overtrained and you know, what I, in anything, by the way, but I think that there's this thing, you know, what I've read and the research I've done is in a lot of departments, it's 4 hours a year of hand-to-hand combat training. And, you know, like that, that's nothing. And the truth is that, you know, if you're somebody who hasn't had hands on you in 2, 3, 4, 5 months, when somebody puts their hands on you, that's uncomfortable and it's going to put you on your back foot. And I have so much respect for, you know, your son. The first thing he said is that's what I would use out on the field. And it's not to go out and fuck people up. It's not to go and beat people's ass. It's so you can say, hey, look, man, you know, I was listening to Renner Gracie, you know, from the famous Gracie. And he, you know, he's going around the country now and he's doing seminars with cops. And basically they had this thing in Marietta, Georgia, where all the cops train jiu-jitsu, you know, even the old guys, like everyone, it's mandatory. They cut down officer related injuries by 100%, suspect injuries by 50%. They've had no complaints of police brutality since the training's begun. And basically what they said is guys are putting people down on the ground. They're holding them, basically getting a full mount and talking to them, being like, listen, man, I got you. Just calm down.
And I think the thing is it's quick. Yeah, it doesn't go on.
But it's also not about bashing somebody over the head with a baton or shooting
them
or
getting them down.
It's being able to. And I think this idea that we should pull that kind of funding or that you know that we should have guys spend less time with it is so fucking insane to me. Like you said, the thing that drew you to the Marines, what drew you to the police force, here you are, community minded, good men, family men, kind men, competent men, but you're loyal men. And there's a loyalty and a brotherhood among police officers, which needs to be there. Your guys' lives, the community's safety is on the line with you guys operating, having each other's backs, and that you can trust each other.
Well, we've been in situations where we saw where things could have gone farther, but being older officers, we just grab people and just shove them out of the way. You know, at least the officers, it's like, okay, I'll take over from here.
Because you saw an officer going too far.
I saw an officer potentially, you know, where he's being baited. The guy wants to fight anyway. Yeah. And
Jerry
the officer
was telling me that.
One thing you don't do, you really avoid, is giving up real estate. Okay? But there's a time where you just back up. And if you have to, you go for the taser or your pepper spray. Or me personally, you know, if let's say I have someone that's out of control, they're not armed.
Right.
But they need to go to jail or they need to be put under control. So what you do is you rush them. Everyone grab an arm. Everyone grab a leg. We handcuff them. Sure. And if he needs to go to the hospital, we take him to the hospital.
I think one of the things is also being aware of the environment. You know, I think because Jeff nailed it perfectly. Police work isn't pretty. And you can't make it pretty, but you can make it quick. You talked about, get them down, hook them up, and getting them out. You know, and that's the thing. How many times do we say after arrest, let's get the arrestee back at the station?
We've been surrounded before.
Yeah.
We're not new to that.
But the main thing, as long as that person that you're arresting is there, it's going to create a crowd. So once you arrest that person, get them into custody, put them into the car, and get them out of there, the crowd doesn't have anything.
Any officer that wears a badge should know some form of open hand combat. Because then you would actually exemplify a confidence where a lot of these cons, you got to admit, they pry and they pick to see if you either show fear or if you turn around and you go, they'll see the experience. So my thing is, you know, I had to do it all over again. I would, you know, it just... great to have had that experience where I've had my face broken before, broken my knuckles, and it wouldn't be a new thing to me if I got into a fight. And when you run into cons that try and lure you in, they'll see it. But if you didn't and you show fear and you start yelling and start barking orders, you know, it's good to do that if you need to. But you got to know when you're being baited, you know, it's just experience.
I agree with that. I wish I got more into the martial arts and everything early in my life, too.
But he can take a beating, though.
Yeah, I can take a beating. But I see a lot more officers involved in it more than ever, you know, that are involved in,
big time.
jujitsu, and it's just, to me, a lot. I see the t-shirts and, you know, of the Gracie Academy shirts and everything like that. So
yeah, I mean, it's having a huge effect. I mean, the thing is, that he's doing,
training's gonna change. Yeah. It's coming. But to me, is you gotta have money. So we get back to the defund the police. We need that money. Training doesn't come cheap. We have to get more and more and more training because the job is so complex now. You know what I mean? There's just so much. There's no easy radio call now.
And everything, anything you do can cause political turmoil.
I mean, look, so everyone's
to me, we hired the best of the best kids.
And to me, it is literally the honor of my life to be able to portray service members of any kind and do it with full heart and say, I know a little bit. I know a little bit. Like, I've walked that walk a little bit. And I'll, as much as they'll let me, I mean, you know, as much as they'll let me walk it, I'll fucking walk it.
Do you feel like a commitment because they let you in? You feel
fucking
that?
Fucking it. Yes. And you're with me. Because, I mean, every step I take in it, you know, whether it's Punisher, it's everybody. It's funny, like Gunny Farnsworth, you know, Gunnery Sergeant, like, I work with him in the Pacific. He's with me 10 years later. I'm remembering things that he said. I'm remembering things like riding with Jerry all night, riding with you, you know, the stuff in Shreveport. I mean, I'm these are like my brothers, you know what I mean? And to be honest with you, the one difference I'll say, you know, that I think that I've had is that I also do it with the other side of the tracks. You know, I also ride with the gangsters. Yep. I also ride with the guys in the mob. I've also ride, you know, because there is this thing by being a storyteller where I can go in and I can say, hey, look, no, I'm just here to learn. I'm just here to learn. And I'll go as far as you want me to go. There's nothing that's going to scare me. There's nothing's going to shake me. I'll go as far. And it's an unbelievable privilege and an honor. But what I think fundamentally what my job is at the end of the day is to fucking empathize, is to open up and say, look, I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to judge your actions. I'm not going to I'm going to look at, because what I see is that most people, almost all people, love their families. They want what's best. They're playing the cards that they're dealt. And you're either real, you're either who you say you are, or you're pretending. Like, that's either you're one or the other. You know what I mean? My heart really hurts right now, you know, for the state of this country. And I think that, you know, we're in this situation. I've said it before, where it's just, you know, it's the people on the far sides of this thing that are just talking a bunch of shit, and they're doing it from computer screens, and they think that they know, and it's just this sickness on both sides. And to me, I think that the people who actually operate in the middle, the people who actually operate and have to come in contact with each other like you guys do, that's who we need to be listening to right now. That's who because you, I've seen you, like, you have empathy for those people. Those people respect you. That doesn't mean that you're not going to take it to them if need be. But the thing that I find is that, you know, when I was down there with my friends from Shreveport, who, you know, it's like the wild fucking West right now. You know, you wouldn't believe what's that thing you were talking about, New Year's. My buddy showed down in Shreveport, showed me a video, and I'm friends with police officers down there, and I'm friends with guys who've grown up on the other side. And that's what they're doing. New Year's. It sounded like, you know, Afghanistan, you know, guns everywhere. And you never know. My friend who just got out 25 years in prison down in Louisiana, he's lost two daughters to gun violence just since he's been out of prison. You know, it's crazy down there. And, you know, when you talk to people in those communities, they're not saying defund the police. They're not saying abolish the police. They're saying we need more police. I was down in the Pueblos last week. They're saying we need police presence. We need this. They are saying we need it to be different. There are cops going down there trying to prove shit. Again, getting out of the car full of fucking fear. And, you know, I think that if we can illuminate and celebrate the guys that are going down there and doing it in a righteous way, in a real way, making connection, being straight up, saying, hey, man, like, we're in this together. This is what we're doing here. You fucked up. We got to go. I'm not going to embarrass you. I'm not going to try to impose my will on you. This is, you know, I'm doing my job, and you did yours, and here we fucking are.
We have to do our job still. We can't turn a blind eye if something is going on. And, you know, I think that, you know, what we're doing now is we have these units inside housing developments right now, and We have the gang of liaison that we could go through and handle problems on a different level. Like Jeff said, we're not going to rest our way out of this. So if we have the gang interventionists that we could go to and they could handle these, you know, light problems. But if it's something that's heavy, like narcotics and shooting, and we, you know, right now we have, you know, there's gang wars on the street right now. Now, that's a serious problem.
Yep.
So, and so it's a balancing act, and we have to work with within our department, the gang units, narcotics units, patrol, but we also have to work with them. And the main thing is we got to keep peace on the street.
And because of the, and I don't know how much you can talk about this, but because of the officer involved shooting that went down there, is there a specific beef right now between Newton and the Pueblos, or can we not talk about that? Or what do you think about that?
It's, you know, it's a very touchy subject. I was working that night.
Yep.
They shot the officer.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yes. I was there that night, and that's a tough position for, you know, officers. Very, that's an ultimate sensitive, you know, to move past something like that was a test, and I'll leave it with this. It's ongoing. It's a process. And
yeah, you know, I mean, like, you know, look,
to have dialogue still. And when you went down there and spoke with them, I'm glad there's still that, you know, that we can have that dialogue. But,
I will say, just from, you know, from seeing the video of what happened that night, you know, for the people that don't know, you know, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but they were in pursuit of a man with a gun. They were chased through the project. And then another man who wasn't involved came, ran, and basically ambushed an officer, shot him. And whoever that officer is who got shot reacted immediately and took that guy down. By the grace of God, I believe that officer is okay.
I'm very close with him. And we speak weekly. And he's at Newton back. He's at Newton still. But I'm very close with him. But, man, it ached me. That night, that was a really, really tough night, because I was there and, you know, my name was being yelled. And, you know, the cops acted, the Newton cops that were at that scene were absolutely phenomenal. I mean.
And can I ask you something? One of the things that the guy said, and I don't know if this, I couldn't really understand because there's a lot of people who are talking. It was something that I stayed late and they were having that barbecue for the young kids that got killed. And they were saying that, I guess at one point, I don't know if it was the same night, but I guess there was like almost this huge kind of confrontation and you put your arms up in the air and you kind of squashed the whole thing. Was that night you really earned their respect? Because the way that the story was told to me is that you put your gun away and that when you watch that video, you know, to me, look, it's a hard thing to watch. And again, it was just such an unbelievable reminder of the risk that police officers take. But you also hear, you know, the screaming from the women and the kids, you know, this young man who was killed, and the pain, and you can see that you're in their, you know, home, and you guys are getting descended upon. And the way they said it is that you put your gun down and you put your hands up in the air, and you just said, everybody, let's calm down. And you brokered the peace by, again, you know, not pointing a weapon, not saying, get the fuck back, not. And that's not to say that doing that, like, I don't know what I would do in that situation, but I mean, look, I love you and I think you're the, like, but like, I that meant the world to me. 'Cause that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, you can hear all this shit now from people who want to talk tough and want to say, do this, do that. And then here's a guy in the heat of the moment that put his gun away and put his hands in the air and calmed down the situation. And to me, like, I don't even know if that's how it was explained to me. That's how you're being talked about there. And, you know,
it's a huge amount of credibility and respect.
Well,
he had for a lot of people some people in that community don't like him, but they respect him, and you can't expect more than that.
Well,
for him to be able to at least calm things down enough to where people can take a breath is huge.
It was a rough night. I was pretty mentally, I never did that in my career. And I couldn't sleep that whole night afterwards, you know, obviously with an officer, you know, that I truly really care for, you know. And the other part was, did I cross the line? You know, and
how so?
Well, you know, I went into, you know, I went into the crowd and to, you know,
that's really frowned upon, because if you go into chaos like that, your brother officers are going to be like, what an idiot, but they're still going to go in there and get you in the middle of people yelling because you don't know what's going to happen.
I mean, I'm just glad it worked out, you know, but mentally I was spent.
He was desperate to de-escalate the situation. It worked.
Well, my name, you know, my name's being yelled out, you know, and
what were they saying?
Just call my name and, you know, ask, you know, asking, you know, for help or whatever it might be. You know, and like I said, the officers at that scene, I'm telling you, I had about what, 29 years on around there. They were phenomenal that night. Absolutely phenomenal from supervisor down. So, you know, being in a position at that point is, that was my responsibility. I felt, you know, I needed to do it. And if there was a chance I could do it, I'm just glad it worked out the way it did, you know. But it was, you know, once the officer was okay and, you know, I had time to think about it, but, you know, but it turned out okay. You know, a lot of officers came up to me and thanked me. And it comes down to one thing, is just training, and then also retraining yourself more and more. Because I don't know, man, 20 years is a long time to do.
Sure.
I don't know how young cops are going to do 20 years, never mind 30. It's just really a hard job. But you nailed it, John. It's got to be, you know, training where we can get, you know, and cops, police love training. A lot of cops love training, especially the young guys. And so I don't think that's going to be a problem if we get resources in there, right, to train people.
If you could change anything right now about...
Well, definitely I would not defund the police. It's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. Get rid of the police.
More training.
And using us as a scapegoat for society's ills. Hey, we're just public servants and we're out there. So training is number one. You don't cut training. You make training number one. Who has the highest standards? And you go by that. Everybody else, you'd be shocked to go into, you know, certain towns where the officers do what they can. They just don't have the budget and they didn't get the training. That's for sure.
When we came on in the academy, you had to do one lap to simulate a foot pursuit, and then you slip on boxing gloves and you go at it with the person you're chasing. And you would be amazed how many people didn't know how to fight on a basic level.
And you punch them in the face once and they just curl up. That's what they found was the problem with some officers. As soon as they get hit in the face, they weren't raised that way. They were never hit. The parents never even hit them. And so when they get hit in the face, they didn't know what to do.
It's
so
incredible.
In the academy, they had us run around. Then we go in the ring, and you're facing off with people who've never raised a fist in their life. You kind of feel sorry for them. That was it.
Come on,
you can't go far.
Yeah, they got rid of that. I forgot what year, and I think that took away a lot, because you learn a lot from being punched.
And you learn a lot about yourself. You
know? Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Maybe you decided the same for you, you know? You decided the same.
I think that can change the way you look at things, getting punched in the face on anything, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you get punched in the face the first time, I mean, I think we all remember our first fight or, you know, whatever. You're like, whoa, wait, I'm still in the game. But if, you know, you just learn from it. My uncle used to tell me a good ass kicking goes a long way.
Right.
And he was absolutely right. And I'm not even physically, I'm talking like
in everyone.
Mentally,
yep.
Where you can't get that job and you want that job and you're better than this person, but they keep it, these people that are not as good as you advancing, you know? And Jeff and I.
Have you been to the academy when they do a lot of the simulations?
No.
That's where.
Oh, yeah. We can take
you actually
it
expose
that,
officers to a situation they've never been in. So you don't want them experiencing it there. So you bring up those situations there at the academy. They have like a little miniature city there where they'll expose these people to it. And the way they react, you'll be critiqued after that. And so then you'll find, okay, maybe I could have done that better. A shoot, non-shoot situation. Have you been through our simulation where you shoot or don't shoot?
No.
We could put you through that.
Oh, you've never been through that?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know what? That's where some of the political leaders have been put through there.
Okay.
The shoot, no shoot situations. And they change their tune afterwards because it's easier, like you said, to be over here and say, well, I would have shot him in the hand.
That's right.
I would have done this. Well, there was one where she was yelling at the suspect on the screen. And the guy kept beating the lady with some metal object, and they stopped it. And they go, "Well, if that was your mother, what would you do?" Mm-hmm. "Well, I would have shot him." After you go in, and the crime is ongoing, you're able to do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And so she learned there that it wasn't as cut and dry. I mean, like you said, we've pointed out where any situations won't step away from chaos. So,
well, knowing you're in that world, was it every day? How often would you ask yourself, you know, is something terrible going to happen today?
Every day.
Every day
it can happen, especially where we were. We were put in the worst areas. And if a gang unit's off for the weekend, we took over that area. But if you don't say that to yourself, be prepared. Anything can happen.
And how would you, how specifically would you say that to yourself? Like what's the conversation? Was it,
oh,
did you say it to in the morning?
Mentally, when you get to work, you get the uniform on, anything that happened at home, hopefully you leave it there and you're there. Your responsibility is to get your partner home,
yep,
at the end of the night, and don't do anything stupid to get you both in jail or sued, and to serve the community the best you can. So when we go out there, When you see officers reacting in those shootings, their mind's in the situation. That's nowhere else. Because if you don't sit in that car and not expect anything, you're going to get yourself or your partner killed.
Like I said, we all have a choice to work in LAPD and where to work, you know, in the Valley or the West Side or, you know, Central Bureau and stuff. But, you know, Jeff chose to do majority of his time in Hollenbeck Division, East LA, and I decided to do my time in Newton. And I have no regrets. I know he doesn't. And I'm really close, you know, to the community with Newton. I'm really, really close, you know.
I was close to the community where I'm at in, yep, Boyle Heights.
Yep.
Wonderful people, yes, beautiful families.
Yeah.
Yep. And like I said, we've lost a couple, tragically. And but if you look up our program, you see a lot of what we do. It's a huge family repair program. We have soccer programs. You got to give these kids something to do.
Yes.
But why is it, with so much out there, it all lands on our lap?
But I really believe that, you know, it might take a few years, but I believe the, you know, all this, the pendulum will swing back where we're all working a lot better together. No doubt in my mind.
Thanks for being here, everybody. I really appreciate it. If you dug what you saw and you want to hear more, subscribe, like, do all that stuff. It'd mean a lot to us. I hope you dig these episodes as much as we dig doing them. You guys take care of yourself.